I've been a journalist for over 30 years, and I actually have not really seen something seem to really spread like this other than maybe in 2020. ICE was not the only agency involved with the series of arrests that happened on June the 6th there in Los Angeles. It was actually an enforcement action that targeted a garment company for allegations beyond immigration violations. We're talking stuff like tax evasion, customs fraud, and money laundering. A lot of these signs look like they were, you know, professionally made. And so we have a very well-funded, very well-supported protest movement here that may not be entirely organic.
Welcome to Constitution Avenue, a podcast from the Epoch Times, where we decipher the three branches of the U.S. government, from the halls of Congress to the Oval Office. I'm Sam Dorman, and these are my co-hosts, Nathan Wester.
Hi there.
And Janice Heisel.
Hello.
Today we're going to discuss the ongoing spending battle in Congress and the chaos unfolding in Los Angeles. First, I want to go over to Nathan and see what kind of drama is unfolding in Congress. What can you tell us, Nathan?
Thanks, Sam. I got to say, you know, before I turn to the Capitol, those images out of Los Angeles, Mexican flags, plumes of fire, deployed National Guards and Marines, those have been dominating everybody's consciousness even over the past week or so. You even have multiple protests against ICE raids spreading across the U.S. All that is to say, this might have not been the best time on Capitol Hill for somebody to question border spending in the big mega bill, the one big beautiful bill that is oh so slowly making its way through. But Rand Paul, the chair of the Homeland Security Committee and a very libertarian Republican, he went ahead and did so.
And I am a believer that we are acting fiscally irresponsible at every level of government across government, and that you can't just sort of be fiscally conservative when it's convenient. When it comes to the border, oh, but anything that rolls, anything does. And that's the attitude here.
But first, some context. The Senate is considering this bill that is intended to realize President Trump's agenda. Now, the House already passed it. That was a very exhausting process for Speaker Mike Johnson. And they're using a process called reconciliation. It gets a little complicated. The upshot is that they only need 51 votes with reconciliation to get it through the Senate, which the Republicans have to rely on because they couldn't get the 60 they would normally need. But they only have 53 votes in the Senate, so it's not like they have a lot of margin. They really do have to fight for member support. The target for this all, bear in mind, is still July 4th. Some people are raising questions about that. I mean, that's only weeks away now, but it is a packed June. They would have to get it not only through the Senate, but then get a compromise version if their differences between the Senate and the House version passed, hammered out in some form, and then President Trump would have to sign it. Now, that's a lot of steps. And already, with Rand Paul raising questions, this appears to be something with hiccups along the way. So his biggest issue is the way that it raises the debt ceiling over $4 trillion. But as I said, in addition to that, he has concerns about how much it's asking on border security. And he's the chair of the committee handling border security in the mega bill. So $46.5 billion, that's what they're asking for the border wall and for associated infrastructure. For some context, the Homeland Security Secretary, Kristi Noem, she testified to Congress in May that the miles built so far in Trump's second term cost about $12 million per mile. And Rand Paul cited this statistic with reporters saying that means that $46.5 billion should be more like $12 billion or so. And this is not the first set of objections he raised. He had his objections during a June 11th meeting. This was a closed-door session with Senate Republicans. He told reporters afterwards that there were a few receptive people there in that crowd.
That there were many people in the room who actually are open to looking at the actual expenses and trying to be conservative on the expenses. I was somewhat surprised because these are ideas that I've been talking about publicly but haven't had a lot of support for. But I would say in private, there's quite a few people in there who actually do think that we did save some money and are open-minded to it and believe the administration should justify the numbers.
Now, Lindsey Graham also emerged from that same meeting, a Trump loyalist, including on this spending bill. He had an alternative plan. He did say that there were perhaps some issues with the numbers, or at least not enough justification, but he voiced criticism of what Paul was talking about.
maybe we can find some savings there, but Senator Paul's numbers are just not realistic.
The next day, a human symbol of the administration's tough on the border agenda, Stephen Miller, came to Capitol Hill, and I actually watched him hustle out of his meeting with Senate Republicans to a waiting SUV, saw him do the nod and wink to someone who was just past me, so appreciated the little taste of Miller time. And I had a chance to hear directly from one of the most skeptical members of the Senate when it comes to spending, another member of the Homeland Security Committee. He's been making the podcast circuit, going on the All In podcast, going on Tucker Carlson, Wisconsin's Ron Johnson. He came out of this meeting and he said that he was wowed, basically, by what Stephen Miller talked about. So here's some of his reaction.
Stephen did a really good job laying out just the complexity of what they're having to deal with, the expense of all these things. We were just looking for some basic numbers because they weren't quite adding up, but he fully explained it.
And I asked Johnson if his colleagues would support that full $150 billion ask from the White House. And here's what he said.
If anything, we maybe ought to need more.
So just to clarify, he did immediately tell me after that they're not going to bump the number above $150 billion. But that's a lot of confidence. Now, Rand Paul, the big skeptic of the border spending, he wasn't in the Miller meeting on the 12th. But he told reporters afterwards that he was still concerned about that big ask from the administration on the border. But he also acknowledged that at this stage, his Republican colleagues can find ways to sidestep him.
Well, I probably don't have the majority because it doesn't need to polarize the board. So I understand that. I mean, the majority will get what they want.
Now, as Paul was voicing his concerns over the bill earlier this week, he revealed something pretty dramatic. Apparently, the White House had disinvited him from the White House Congressional Picnic, which is something members of Congress go to every year. But there was a salvation. On June 12th, he announced on Twitter the news of his reinvitation with a picture of his grandson in a MAGA cap. So I suppose some sort of attempt to rebuild the bridge there. Recall that this also comes after the spat between Elon Musk and Trump on Twitter and on Truth Social. In the last few days, we've seen Elon Musk attempt to repair that relationship, delete some of the more provocative things he posted. And I have to say, on the Hill, when all of this was happening, I actually saw Paul and his grandson walking through the Capitol, had a chance to, you know, see some of the members in a slightly more human context. Actually, Utah Senator John Curtis's grandson, who I can tell you was very polite even to the media. So the mega bill and all the controversy around the spending and just exactly what is going to make it through the Senate, what might not make it, and how President Trump's going to realize his agenda, that's going to continue for weeks on end. And so enough about what's happening on the Hill. Janice is going to share more details on what's been happening in Los Angeles and who may be behind it. Take it away, Janice.
So this situation that started almost a week ago in Los Angeles, it actually feels like way more than a week because there's been things happening just literally every single day. And today we actually had several developments, some fireworks on Capitol Hill that are related to this, involving the largely Republican contingent questioning some Democrat governors about being sanctuary states. And, you know, that is, of course, the situation in California, where they're trying to give protection to the illegal immigrants and refuse to cooperate with the federal immigration authorities, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. So that happened on Capitol Hill. Then we also had in Los Angeles, the Department of Homeland Security Director Kristi Noem was having a news conference when a Democratic Senator, Alex Padilla, crashed the press conference and literally was forcibly removed from the room. So that's making big news today as well. On top of that, we have Governor Greg Abbott from Texas, and he just issued an order using that catchphrase, "Don't mess with Texas." He is deploying 5,000 National Guardsmen along with 2,000 state troopers to go help local law enforcement keep the peace as these protests spread across the nation, especially considering that this Saturday, there are going to be about 1,800 cities with protests that were previously planned to counter President Trump's big celebration that's happening in Washington, D.C. Now, that celebration involves the 250th anniversary of the founding of the Army, as well as Flag Day. And it happens to also coincide with the president's 79th birthday. So much going on there. And we'll just have to see where all of this leads. One of the biggest other developments today was that we had an arrest by the FBI in Los Angeles. And that was of a guy that was distributing, allegedly, face shields, sophisticated face shields to some of those protesters in Los Angeles. And that's part of the larger investigation into who is funding this and why. Now for an update on the state versus federal court battles and how that ties into the Los Angeles riots. Take it away, Sam.
Thanks, Janice. Yeah, you're talking about the National Guard and some of the sanctuary policies. It's really interesting to me because I think all of this is really bringing to a head how the lawsuits against Trump are forcing the judicial branch to wrestle with this idea of presidential power and how far it extends for Trump and his policies. So can Trump use state resources for his own purposes? That's sort of the main question that some of the legal arguments are getting at in LA and other jurisdictions. In both Newsom's lawsuit and Trump's lawsuits against sanctuary jurisdictions, states are claiming that the federal government basically attempting to violate the 10th Amendment of the Constitution. So that amendment generally says that all the powers not designated for the federal government are, quote unquote, reserved for the states. So at a basic level, the Constitution lists certain powers for the federal government. And the idea is that the ones that aren't specifically identified for the federal government are left for the states to handle. So that is usually things like schools, law enforcement, things like that. Newsom is arguing that Trump's decision to federalize the National Guard violated multiple federal laws. But he's also saying that Trump is encroaching on the state's authority over law enforcement within the state. Counter to this, the Justice Department has said that they're not trying to take over law enforcement, but instead protect federal assets in California. In a court filing, the DOJ talked about how a federal courthouse was vandalized and immigration enforcement encountered various attacks. The issue is raising some of the same questions that we've seen pop up in other lawsuits. For example, in May, a federal judge in California blocked Trump's executive order aimed at defunding sanctuary jurisdictions. And what was his reason? You may have guessed it, the judge cited none other than the 10th Amendment as the reason for blocking Trump. That judge and some of the places sued by Trump say that the 10th Amendment doesn't allow the president to commandeer state resources for their own enforcement activities. Other jurisdictions like the cities of Rochester and Chicago have used the same argument. They've pointed to something known as the anti-commandeering doctrine of the 10th Amendment. So it's interesting to me that in both Newsom's situation and the sanctuary jurisdictions, there are questions about state resources and how the federal government can use them. Now, when it comes to the National Guard issue, the law is a bit different. One of the primary laws Newsom and Trump are fighting over came from something known as the Militia Act, which was passed at the beginning of the 20th century. That law allows presidents to call National Guard troops into service under certain circumstances. For example, presidents can exercise this authority when there's a rebellion or the president is unable to execute federal law. Newsom's lawsuit is basically saying Trump can't just charge ahead and take control of the National Guard without taking additional steps. More specifically, the lawsuit has suggested that there should be some kind of consultation or even potentially permission from Newsom before Trump federalizes the state's National Guard. The Trump administration, meanwhile, has said the law makes Newsom a mere conduit for Trump's decision. So eventually there was a hearing on the issue on June 12th. That same day, Judge Charles Breyer of the Northern District of California issued an order stating that Trump must return control of the National Guard to Newsom. Trump's actions, Breyer said, were, quote, illegal, both exceeding the scope of his statutory authority and violating the 10th Amendment to the United States Constitution. However, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit quickly intervened and put a temporary hold on Breyer's order. That means a final ruling on the legality of Trump's actions is still pending. And before we go on, I just want to mention that before the recording, DOJ filed another sanctuary-related lawsuit against New York. And this is I think the third sanctuary-related lawsuit they filed against the state, or they've also filed one against Rochester. So basically, when ICE arrests an illegal immigrant, but the individual hasn't committed a specific crime, it's called a civil violation, and or it could be called a civil immigration arrest. And the DOJ is now alleging that the state is obstructing federal immigration enforcement with a law that bars civil immigration arrests at courthouses. So I'm planning to keep an eye on all this. Like I said, I think it's raising interesting questions, and Trump is raising a lot of questions about the nature of presidential authority and the balance of power between states and the federal government. But I want to get back to LA and some of the details and what's going on there, because it really has been intense. And like Janice said, I feel like it's been longer than a week. But Janice, I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit about more what's happened, and just from your own experience as a journalist, what kind of parallels do you see between what's going on in LA and what's happened in other protests around the country?
Sure. Well, I've got to say that I've been a journalist for over 30 years, and I actually have not really seen something seem to really spread like this, other than maybe in 2020. A lot of people are comparing it to what a lot of people call the summer of love. 2020, we had all those George Floyd protests, and there's quite a lot of concern out there in the public, either on social media and even just people I've spoken to, telling me they're worried that the goal here among these protesters is to agitate law enforcement to the point where somebody ends up dead and there's a martyr for the cause, basically. So that is a huge concern, that we could have a loss of life here. Another thing that I wanted to point out is that I really feel like a lot of times in our crazy fast-paced media world, when a story first breaks, it's hard to correct some information that may not be 100% accurate at the beginning. And I think that's actually what happened here, because ICE was not the only agency involved with the series of arrests that happened on June the 6th there in Los Angeles. It was actually an enforcement action that targeted a garment company for allegations beyond immigration violations. We're talking stuff like tax evasion, customs fraud, and money laundering. So there were, I believe, four agencies involved, including the IRS. And so, but everybody just says it's ICE protest, and all the signs say ICE. But really, what is afoot here? It's hard to say. Are people just latching onto the ICE because it's the immigration thing and not looking at the larger issue? That's something I keep wondering about.
Yeah. You know, I kind of wonder myself, having been in Chicago during the summer of love, the summer of Floyd, in a lot of the media coverage, especially more conservative media, there was a great deal of talk of like Antifa or other, you know, organized left-wing groups. But I also saw, when it came to some of the looting that took place, when it came to a lot of the violence, frankly, there was just a lot of opportunism. There were, I think, criminals taking advantage of the situation. So, you know, this goes to you, Janice, as you're scrutinizing the news, especially what you're seeing out of Los Angeles. Are you seeing something that appears to be more coordinated, more top down, or are we seeing a lot of like criminal opportunism, something a little less organized, or maybe a mixture of both?
From what I've seen, if I had to give my opinion, I would say it's a mixture of both. One of the biggest questions that a lot of people, including me, would have is that, you know, the signs, a lot of these signs look like they were, you know, professionally made. And, you know, the one guy that was arrested today for distributing the shields, these shields were not cheap. They range from about $30 to $50. I've even seen some of them for sale for like $75 a piece. So if you're handing out dozens or hundreds of these, we're talking about some pretty big money. And also, there were full-page ads taken out in major newspapers across the country promoting these protests that are supposed to be happening this weekend. And those were actually funded by Christy Walton from the Walmart family. And so we have a very well-funded, very well-supported protest movement here that may not be entirely organic. It seems like there are some forces behind the scenes that are really pushing this.
It's interesting. I was just going to ask. So, Nathan, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how people, members of Congress, have been responding to the events in LA.
Well, you know, it definitely varies by party. I would say that many Republican senators and Congress members have been very fulsome in condemning what they've seen, speaking about the chaos. And in the case of, for example, Nancy Mace, he told me essentially that the federal government should take over Los Angeles, given what she's seeing. Now, that's a fairly strong opinion. On the other hand, Hakeem Jeffries, Speaker of the House, earlier today, he reiterated something that Democrats have generally said, which is that any sort of criminality, anything that moves into the territory of violence, they condemn that. But on the other hand, they support the right under the First Amendment for people to protest and to make their voices heard. Then, of course, you wonder about, for example, the big story of today, a senator getting into this scuffle with a member of the U.S. Secret Service. And does that somehow, I mean, depending upon the observer, I suppose that could be construed as, you know, innocent protest and encroachment by law enforcement. But at a certain point, you do kind of have to wonder how all these terms are actually being used and how sincere the people using them are in all times and all circumstances.
Yeah, one of the biggest things that is also coming out of this, I'm hearing a lot of criticism of people who are, most of them Democrats, saying that these protests aren't violent. Don't believe what you see, basically. And that's another concern about the manipulation of the news and the American psyche perceptions of what's happening.
Yeah, it's a very tense atmosphere, I'd say. I think House Democrats were supposed to talk about the Padilla incident in a press conference. But besides that, this is also, you know, while this was happening, there was also a hearing on sanctuary jurisdictions. And like Governor Hochul from New York was getting grilled by Representative Elise Stefanik on this issue. So it's interesting, like almost 10 years after Trump tried to make immigration the central issue, it's really, really causing a lot of conflict. And it's really, you're seeing a lot of conflict between the parties on that issue.
Well, I think it's not so much that he tried to make it an issue is that it was a huge issue, and he was a politician who spoke about it in a way that, for example, in the era prior to Trump, this was something where you had attempts at amnesty, you had a radically different attitude, especially from Republicans, and, you know, at least electorally, that was clearly a loser for them. But, you know, even a decade before that, there was a very different view on immigration in the mainstream among Democrats, too. I think it was more a matter of, as we've seen, not just in the case of Trump, but in populist politics across the planet, in Europe, in Asia, elsewhere, just a general opposition to mass immigration, especially illegal, but mass immigration in general is animating politics. And I think you would give Trump too much credit if you were to say that he created that as an issue. I think we're just seeing this play out in much the same way in places across the planet.
You're right. He didn't create it as an issue. It was definitely an issue before. And I guess I'm just thinking about, you know, George Bush and some other Republicans pushing for immigration reform, how different they are from Trump, and just how different, how he kind of, I feel like he very much changed the conversation. And he did it at a, you know, it was a timely maneuver, because I think, as you're talking about, this has become an issue across the world. And so he's shining a spotlight on it, but it is sort of rearing its head in other ways as well.
I'm sorry. For some additional context, I did want to point out that I wrote a story a year ago about the mayor of Hazleton, Pennsylvania, making international news for trying to take action against illegal immigration. And that was in 2006. And he actually was the first person that I was able to find in a government position that highlighted this, and that he actually ascended to Congress after that battle in his little town, little corner of Pennsylvania.
Okay, well, thank you for listening to Constitution Avenue with Sam Dorman, Nathan Wester, and Janice Heisel. Join us again next week for the most intriguing topics in news and politics, and be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts.